Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is brought to you by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in new ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. This episode of the Let's Get Busy podcast is sponsored by Gallery Nucleus, a gathering place for the illustration art-loving community that specializes in high-quality prints and art books from some of your favorite children's book illustrators. Christian Robinson will be exhibiting original illustrations from his books Gaston, Josephine, and Leo, A Ghost Story, his latest book, at the gallery September 19th through October 11th. Gallery Nucleus is offering listeners of the Let's Get Busy podcast 15% off your next purchase by entering in the promo code BUSY15 at checkout. That's BUSY15. Visit gallerynucleus.com to browse original artwork and prints and bring your favorite art home. And by The Writer's Loft. The Writer's Loft in Sherbourne, Massachusetts is a retreat, a conference, and a writer's room of requirement, all rolled into one supportive community. Like a year-long writing conference, The Loft hosts classes and workshops led by the likes of Aaron Dion, A.C. Goggin, Lori Griffin Burns, and Jen Malone. The Loft also hosts frequent panels and free craft chats with authors and illustrators such as Linda Mullally Hunt, Sarah Brannan, Anna Staniszewski, Josh Funk, and more. The Loft offers critiques from agents and editors and hosts monthly write-ins, social gatherings, manuscript mixers, and book launches. It also is home to critique groups and think tanks for writers and illustrators in all genres, for those who are traditionally published, self-published, and pre-published. And like many a good writing retreat, the Writer's Loft always has a quiet space for you to write. The Writer's Loft is a 501c3 organization centrally located just west of Boston, but not far from the New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut borders, with members from all over New England. For more information about their groups and upcoming events, please visit thewritersloft.org. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 190 of the Let's Get Busy podcast with Catherine Applegate, Newbery Award-winning author of The One and Only Ivan, whose newest book, Crenshaw, is published by Fywell & Friends, an imprint of Macmillan. Crenshaw is a magical book, and it deals with some really hard-to-address themes, mainly homelessness and the many varied forms coping can take. I found it to be an absolutely captivating book, and as is often the case, I ended up loving it even more so after having the opportunity to talk about it with Catherine. Enjoy the listen. Here is episode number 190 of the podcast with Catherine Applegate. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Catherine Applegate. Hey, we made it. We connected. We're here.
It was with no small amount of effort.
All that effort just makes it even more worth it.
I am known as a terminally disorganized human being, so it's lucky we're here together.
I love that term, a terminally disorganized. I've actually very similarly been known as a terminally tall person, so it's so funny to hear it applied somewhere else.
Well, we fortunately you were very patient and tenacious, so here we are at last.
It's wonderful to be connecting with you at last. And Catherine, my word, what an honor that I get to be here and talk to you about Crenshaw. Oh my gosh, this book is outstanding. Outstanding.
Oh, you're so kind. I should say it's an honor to be chatting with you too, as you have spent many, many hours with me driving up and down the 101. I live in near San Francisco, and you've kept me company. So thank you with your podcast.
Oh, well, thanks for taking me on such a beautiful drive. That's nice to be out there. I was actually going to say to you before recording, and I thought I ought to just tell you here on record that you're with me a lot too, because my wife and I have this great habit in the 10 years or so that we've been married. We always read aloud to one another, and we've read aloud One and Only Ivan together and Home of the Brave together, and we've read aloud Crenshaw together, and this time our 5-year-old has gotten to hear the entire story as well, and it's just so beautiful. And you're an author that I admire for not only being able to write a beautiful story, but making it work so well to be read aloud. You must just have this great admiration for words and the way they fit together, and that's what I like about you.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. You know, I do. I think about sound more than I think about plot sometimes. So often to my detriment. But I like the way, I like thinking about which word will work, and I like writing small. I think I'm more of a chamber music kind of writer than a symphonic kind of writer. Maybe I'm just lazy, but I like paring down, you know, and that's why my books are always so short.
Well, they're always quite poetic too. And you also, gosh, I can't even equate it to chamber music, but it feels to me as though you write this story deliberately daring us to put the book down. One and Only Ivan was that way. And then Crenshaw, I feel like you've amped it up even more, where you just can't stop at the end of a chapter. You're almost forcing my hand to either stop mid-chapter or read the entire book in one go, which is it's such an exciting thing. It's just it's great in that quality.
That's nice to hear. I think of course it's facilitated to some extent by the fact that you know it's so short. And it was a small story, so it you know, that was the format that worked for it. With Ivan, I wanted all that white space on the page to kind of reflect, you know, his very spare existence. And with Home of the Brave, I thought, I'm going to write me some poetry. And I know nothing about poetry. So experimenting with free verse was really a dangerous thing to undertake. But it was fun. And I loved, again, you know, just finding just the right word. And for that particular book, because it was about a Sudanese refugee who was learning the language, writing in free verse, you know, it seemed to work.
I think it worked beautifully. It was nominated at whatever point, whatever year of me being in the library, it was nominated for our state book award. And in that way, we get those books become more present in our libraries, at least in Maryland, they become more present. And book talking them becomes this really wonderful thing, because then you get kids trying to get their teachers to choose this book to read aloud. And that one in particular, I remember how excited the children were, because they don't often get books written in that free verse form. And it made them, caused them to want to go find other books that way, which you can imagine led to such wonderful things as like finding Karen Hess and finding Love That Dog by Sharon Creech and things like that, which is it's awesome when that happens.
You know, it's funny you say that, because Karen Hess was a great inspiration for me. I just adored Out of the Dust.
I could not
believe what she managed to do. I mean, it was so riveting and such a dark and, you know, tough topic to undertake. And she did it so beautifully. So that was actually one of my inspirations. I thought, wow, if I could, you know, even come close to putting words together in the right order the way she does. And I do think that free verse is, strangely enough, often appeals to reluctant readers. I'm sure you find that as a teacher, because there just aren't as many words on the page, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not as intimidating sometimes.
It's a fun thing, though, because while there aren't as many words on the page, the children also get to pick up how carefully selected those words are. When you have to edit down to that degree to be able to communicate something, it's a challenge, and it's something that I think they get a lot more respect for the author when they try it themselves. And writing in free verse allows them to do that. When you look at a novel, when you look at, I don't know, Harry Potter, as much as the children adore that book, trying to sit down to write something like that is daunting, but it doesn't feel as scary to try to write free verse. It's only when you start doing it and you realize, wow, the craft that goes into this is really something exceptional.
Yeah, it's it reminds me a bit when you say that of picture books, because I have this theory that everybody thinks they can write a picture book. I know I was one of those people. And I've written three now, but man, they are hard. And they look so easy because they are, you know, it's just a handful of spreads and a few words tossed on a page and a lot of pictures. How hard could it be? And it's, as anyone who's ever even gone near trying to write one will tell you, it's incredibly difficult. So, yeah, kids realize, I think, once they get into it, that even short sentences are hard sentences. But it also allows for more play with figurative language. You know, it's a lot of times I've had teachers say this was their first taste of metaphor. And you know, they had a lot of fun with that. So that's another advantage, I think, to free verse novels.
Hmm. Well, you've got such a beautiful way of telling stories that I can't help feel that no matter what the format, you are inspiring readers to want to tell stories. And I like that quality. I used to teach fourth grade. I now teach in the library. And so stories have sort of been part of my teaching experience and then part of my life forever. And getting children to be able to see the art and the beauty and see themselves in these stories is really something wonderful. And to bring it back to Crenshaw, to be able to experience something that perhaps they have firsthand experience with or feels very foreign to them, particularly in this, in the topic of homelessness that is approached in Crenshaw, I thought, wow, this is that thing where we cannot in one life experience everything in the world. And so it's through books that we're able to have all of these experiences. And you're doing that here with Crenshaw.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. You can never do this, you know, to go back and do the genealogy on an idea is so hard. But one of the things that happened after winning the Newbery was I got to travel a lot and go to a lot of schools, which is so cool because I love doing school visits. And very often you, if you're lucky, you'll get to go to Title I schools. And they are, you know, the most amazing, wonderful, engaged, enthusiastic kids with such limited resources. And that's not even talking about what the teachers face, just in terms of, you know, finding themselves a pencil when they need it. And yet somehow they manage to do amazing things in those schools. And I think that maybe was where the idea of touching on homelessness and hunger first really, clicked with me. It's such an astonishing thing that we have the problem of childhood hunger in a country as affluent as ours, and that it's right down the street. It's right around. It's probably, you know, a kid sitting three rows down from you. And of course, children never talk about it because it's a very uncomfortable and although it shouldn't be, an embarrassing thing.
That's true.
So yeah, my hope was maybe that this would catalyze a bit of conversation.
You know, I taught and I continue to teach in Title I schools, and you're touching on so many great points here. One, that what a very beautiful thing that through winning the Newbery, I didn't even tell you, congratulations officially for winning the Newbery. Now here's my voice telling you congratulations. I think you've gotten a million tweets from me, but here,
pretty cool, I have to say.
Did you go Dan Santat style with, I saw him this year with the Caldecott, just taking his stickers and sort of putting them on everything. Did you take your extra Newbery stickers and put them on your dog and put them on your coffee pot and things like that?
Oh, you know, I lack Dan's, you know, style, but no, believe me, I celebrated big time, so.
Wow. Well, I was going to bring it back on a more serious note that, working in Title I schools, to be able to have a publisher approach you and say, we're putting together this tour and we'd love to be able to bring this author to you, to be able to have, and through different programs like, the Center for the Book that we have in DC and different things like that, that are able to get authors into these schools that otherwise there's no way they'd be able to afford them. That was always such a really beautiful thing because of getting to put this experience in front of children with someone that there's someone here that perhaps gets them through the stories that they're telling or through the way that they're engaging children or through the way that they just know how to speak to children. And so coming from there, that absolutely, I value that you've had that opportunity to tour. But then it also makes me think, as a teacher, one of the, it's that weird, like, what is it when you, this is Ender's Game, isn't it? When I truly know my enemy, then I can love them, and then I no longer need to fear them. These children, that's not to say that these children are our enemies, but some of the children that act out the most and have the hardest time in school are doing it because that's the only tool they know to get our attention and our help. And so I think of reading Crenshaw, I thought of so many of my students and thinking like, man, there are so many children that are the have-nots and the parents. There's a pride thing that perhaps they don't want to ask out for help because it's embarrassing. There's a stigma to it that there shouldn't be. And I was reading that in Crenshaw too, that you can just feel that, why don't you just ask for help? But how many of us would actually ask for help? That's hard.
It's very hard. And it's so hard at that age too, because you're just beginning to navigate the complexities of the world and, you know, what's fair and what's right and what do I deserve and what can I expect? Is it normal to be hungry? Do all families have, you know, economic problems? Those are things that nobody really talks about. Kids, I think, at that age are very aware of what's going on financially in a household. Of course, we try to shelter them, but in the case of Jackson, who is the main character in Crenshaw, his parents are you know, they're good people. And I wanted a loving, intact family that was just going through some hard times. His dad lost his construction job. He had MS. His mom was downsized. She'd been a music teacher. That, you know, we've seen that happen. God knows.
Absolutely.
And they're you know, cobbling together part-time jobs, trying to keep their heads above water. And that's not an uncommon scenario, unfortunately, in this country. But I do think that kind of strain that families go through when they're faced with financial crises is usually picked up on by kids. And where do you go with that? You know, there's no place to talk about that. I was shocked to see No Kid Hungry is a great resource. It's part of Share Our Strength, and they have a wonderful website for people who are interested on childhood hunger in the U.S. And the stat they use is that about 1 in 5 kids is going to school hungry some of the time. And they talk about teachers, you know, carving money out of their already depleted wallets to provide food for kids during the day. And I'm sure you've seen your share of those kids. And it's was interesting to me as I was researching that very often summer is the hardest time for these kids because the programs we do have in place sort of evaporate over the summer. So that can be a particularly hard time for kids. So all those little data bits kind of were floating around in my head as I started to work on Crenshaw, and I think helped form it. But then, you know, of course, I was already obsessed with the idea of a giant imaginary cat.
Yes. If I could read to you, would you mind if I read to you a part of your book?
I'd rather have you read it than.
Well, I love to preface this for the readers. This story really hinges on not only Jackson's family struggle with impending homelessness and struggling to be able to put food on the table, but there's also this cat that returns to Jackson's life. For when we first meet Crenshaw, it's for the second time in Jackson's life, and certainly the first time since he's, you know, 10 years old or going into fifth grade or being in fifth grade. And Jackson's struggling with why this cat is around, and at one point, sort of frustrated, Jackson says, or Crenshaw says to Jackson, "I don't think you understand what's going on here, Jackson," he said. "Imaginary friends don't come on their own volition. We are invited. We stay as long as we're needed, and then, and only then, do we leave." "Well, I sure didn't invite you." Crenshaw raised an eyebrow. His long, whiskery brows moved like strings on marionette. That right there, that was chills for me. That, to have a character come into this story, not to solve the problem, but to be a reflection back on Jackson, that, that this perhaps, that imaginary friends perhaps are a tool that we use to help understand the situation we're in, or to help us cope or get through that situation, made for such a beautiful note in this story, Catherine. And when we understand Crenshaw and start to see him peeking back up again, the way that that cues the reader and Jackson himself to what is going ahead, I felt really put me right there with Jackson, feeling like, oh my word, we're going to go through this again. It's about to get tough for us. It's okay, Jackson, but it's going to get tough for us. I'm here. And it just felt suddenly like I was there with Jackson, and I was there to help him go through it. I really loved that way that worked.
Oh, that's nice to hear. You know, it's funny because did you ever have an imaginary friend?
I do not recall my imaginary friend, but my son has had an imaginary friend, and Mr. Fox went away. But Mr. Fox was around for about, I think I would say, 6 months, and we would hear all about what he was doing and what he was wearing and how they were playing together.
Mr. Fox. That. Excellent choice. I don't recall having one either. And I think it's such a remarkably charming and really sophisticated way for a child to deal with life. It's a real shame that we adults don't turn to this coping mechanism more often. But the idea of creating this entity that can be a scapegoat or a best friend, a confidant, you know, entertainment is it's so brilliant. And I've always loved the idea. I've always wanted to explore it. I think for me, I had a lot of animals growing up, and I think for me, you know, my dogs were probably a surrogate, served the purpose of imaginary friends. But it just seemed like such a cool thing for a kid to do. And when I talk to people who do recall their imaginary friends, they always have ridiculous names, and they always kind of vanished without a trace rather early. I did read a study, in fact, I actually referenced it in the book, that kids who are like 7 and 8 are still quite often have imaginary friends. That surprised me. Seemed rather old. And apparently they stick around longer than we think.
I thought that same thing when I read that too. that also what a neat thing to be able to put that statistic in there, because I'm at the same time I'm reading this to my 5-year-old and thinking how it does work really well to read with an older sibling and younger siblings that works. And then thinking like, wow, I could be reading this here as I am to my kindergartner or to my first or second grader, and knowing that this is almost, again, giving them permission that, no, it's okay. There were these scientists that did this study, and how great for Jackson being such a realist and a person of a boy of science compared to the rest of his creatives in the family to come back to this weird juxtaposition between what is fantasy and imaginary friend and what is fact, that no, this is a real thing that the children have, and it's okay.
I think it's also a way to kind of write your own story. I mean, the wonderful thing about an imaginary friend is it gives you permission, it seems to me, to think beyond, you know, the boundaries that are typically set for, say, a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old. Something about, you know, imaginary friends can do things that they have, of course, they have superpowers. They can walk through walls. They can do all kinds of things that we would like to do. But they also can be more grown up. They can take on risks that we would never, you know, never undertake ourselves.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting way to kind of play with your own narrative.
So, Catherine, I'm so glad that before I even started reading this book, it was so wonderful to see on page one you reference Harvey.
Oh.
One of my favorite movies of all time. I assume, hearing your sigh, that you as well have such an
I knew I liked you.
Love for that. Isn't that an amazing movie? Come on, James Stewart. It's the greatest.
I think this is a great litmus test for whether you like somebody. Have they seen Harvey? And if not, you know, why not?
Why not?
It's really so charming. It's you know, kind of this small farcical almost to comedy of manners, but it's so much more than that, because it's heartbreaking at points and just so uplifting. And I just, one of the best takes on what it's like to be a human, I think, that's ever been written, and to have done it. And Mary Chase was the author, and to have been that funny. Wow.
Yes.
Just an amazing movie. I actually got the original play, and read it already, of course, having Jimmy Stewart's head in my voice in my head. Yeah. But it holds up beautifully. It's quite amazing.
It's such a beautiful movie too, in the way that Jimmy Stewart plays it straight the entire time. There's never at all, I mean, this is good storytelling too. There's never at all any sort of wink to the audience that, like, hey, this is really ridiculous, isn't it? But more that, no, this is, we're going to play it as sincere as possible to allow us. I mean, you were saying about how sad it is that adults lose imaginary friends and sort of don't have that anymore. And in that movie, we accomplish the feeling of having a safe space to have those feelings as adults. And that's really important to have.
It's and of course the charm of the story is that by the end, pretty much everyone else is buying into the existence of Harvey. So despite the fact that, you know, they begin thinking that Jimmy Stewart is nuts, it's funny that, you know, many people have flirted with remaking that movie. I think Tom Hanks was going to do it for a while, and I think people are afraid to touch it just because it was so perfect. But I do open with a line. The epigraph is, well, you may have it in front of you, I don't, but it basically talks about the fact that Harvey was a name he chose because it had possibilities, and the reason it had so many possibilities was because he'd never known anyone by the name of Harvey. And it's sort of a sly reference to the fact that humans often disappoint us, but it just fit very well with Jackson's search for the perfect name, and he ended up calling his imaginary friend Crenshaw.
The quote is, Dr. Sanderson, think carefully, Dowd. Didn't you know somebody, sometime, someplace by the name of Harvey? Didn't you ever know anybody by that name? And Elwood P. Dowd says, no, no, not one, Doctor. Maybe that's why I always had such hopes for it. I need you to know that I'm like literally sitting on my hands trying not to spoil things in this book, which is so wonderful. There were moments in this, Catherine, where there were parts that were unveiled in the story that felt like, I don't even know that Catherine could have been writing this. I feel like her pen must have just been moving in front of her to write this. In particular, a moment later in the book, revealing Crenshaw's name is about all I can say without feeling like I'm going to spoil it for people. That, where the scene was moving forward and it just almost like a movie script ending where you're sitting hoping, you know, you don't know this movie, but you're hoping it just goes in this direction and then it does. And it felt like, oh my word, Catherine was writing it for me and for all of us. When you feel that, like, you, this is a story that we know where it's going in, and yet we don't. I don't even know how to say it. I obviously can't articulate this. That moment was incredible.
Oh no, I know exactly what you're talking about. That I have that feeling all the time when I'm reading, and sometimes it's just a paragraph that it's moving along and it's so beautiful and the flow is just right, and it's a rhythm. I mean, there's a musicality to it, and you know, you want to make sure they don't end on the wrong note. You know, let's make sure we resolve this chord. And it's such a nice feeling. It's beautiful. It's a connection that you want to have with a writer. And it happens for different reasons. You're right. Sometimes it's just you're intuiting what's going to happen, and then it actually happens that way. And you're so relieved when those moments hit. Sweet, I know. Sweet. Yeah.
Is your writing process like improvising jazz? I see all these wonderful musical references in the way that you talk about writing, which is such a beautiful thing. Music being very close to my heart, and also being married to a music teacher. There's an awful lot of music in our life. And to see things keep coming back to, with you, the musicality of words on a page and of the way things string together and the way a story reveals itself. I'm sure you go through many edits, but are there moments in writing that it does feel like you're just sort of playing along with the rest of the band as you're writing?
Oh, I wish it were always like that. It's almost never like that. No, it's more like pulling teeth, you know. It's and then every now and then, yeah, you have a moment, and those are great, and it's absolutely worth it. It's worth all the blood and sweat and tears. But I'll tell you something, it's a wonderfully easy job. I've had real jobs in my life. I've cleaned toilets and I taught nursery school. I've had real jobs. And believe me, it's, you know, I think you'd be hard pressed, and you could tell me if I'm right about this. It's hard to find writers who complain about writing. I mean, they, you know, they bitch and moan, but fundamentally they know how lucky they are to be doing it.
I would agree. I hear often, and I think this is good, about how difficult it is to write and how you have to really not give up. It's, you know, working so hard through that perspiration of the writing and of the editing process to get to mine out those diamonds. But so often I hear, but it's writing. At the end of the day, I'm telling a story to a child. I'm connecting to a reader, and that sentiment, it's a wonderful thing to be grounded in that sentiment.
I tell kids when I do school visits, that my job basically involves wearing pajamas to work and making stuff up. So I'm paid to be a slob and a liar. And they go, wow, wait a minute. There's a job where you can get paid to lie? And then they think about it and go, yeah, cool. So I don't know. If I'd had a writer come to my school when I was in fourth or fifth grade, I might have started writing a lot sooner.
So before I let you go on Crenshaw, our time, as it does on this podcast, it always flies by, and already I'm looking at the end of our time, but I can't let you go without talking about purple jelly beans. Because in this is one of the other really beautiful things about this story, Catherine, is that you have the significance of purple jelly beans in this story, and the tie that they have to hunger, and also the tie that they have to Crenshaw, that they tie Jackson and Crenshaw together in this way. You've sort of created this talisman that's something that is tangible, and it's something that kids can see this object and never see it the same way again. Much like in Katie Camilla's The Tale of Despero, I feel the same way about Red Thread. That always now my brain will be bound to Red Thread, and I don't even know if that was just sort of a thing that Kate wrote, and it ended up being in the book, much like perhaps for you, jelly beans are just sort of this thing. And perhaps when the book was all finished and said and done, they take on a life greater than even what was originally intended. And perhaps we still have yet to see that, because when this book reaches children, who knows what life the readers will give it. But I'm curious just to see if you had that in mind of creating this sort of physical object that could tie the reader in no small way to the character directly and to this tie to Crenshaw directly.
Oh, you know, what's so funny about that? I was at a dinner, a publisher's dinner at BEA, and talking about the purple jelly bean thing, because when I wrote The One and Only Ivan, I happened to mention that Ivan liked yogurt raisins. And I'm sure I pulled that out of my research at some point. But what I discovered was when you do school visits and you have avid bakers on staff, they can do remarkable things with yogurt raisins. And teachers would make me yogurt raisins, cookies and yogurt raisin, you know, bread. And I had no idea what a sentence I would be enduring on the yogurt raisin bread. So you would think when I was writing Crenshaw, I would have thought, hey, how about artisanal chocolate or truffles or something? No, purple jelly beans. And they're fine. I like a good purple jelly bean. In fact, Mary Van Aken, my publicist, has discovered in purchasing many, many varieties that there are endless forms of purple jelly beans available. Who knew? So I think probably next time I mention a food, I'm going to think a little bit harder about its long-term ramifications. But as a talisman, as a connection between Crenshaw, a very simple, direct connection, it was so useful. And because hunger is underlying so much of the story, and you know, not in overt, overwhelming ways, but it's there subtly all the time. Jackson even shoplifts some food because his little sister is hungry. So it's a connective tissue, I think. And yeah, I will never look at purple jelly beans quite the same way again.
Well, here's where the tie-in was for me, and I just, because my brain sort of lives in these fairy tale worlds sometimes, I saw a connection to Jack in the Beanstalk and these magic beans that were the answer to hunger for the family. And then we have Jackson and Crenshaw and these beans, this beautiful connection to, and that sometimes life just has sort of a way of tying things together that way. And so it's been magical on this podcast to hear these things, because again, that's something that happens, that you wrote this story and your brain told you to have this talisman for whatever reason it did. And sometimes there's some sort of greater force in control of everything. And the way that it can connect and reverberate with other readers is something really special. And so that was just on my mind.
That's wonderful. I love that connection. And what I love too is the fact that that's what readers are supposed to do. I mean, we hand you the object, but then you become the writer. And, you know, every time you pick up a book, you're embellishing, you're imagining, you're taking it past that last page and deciding what happens to characters. You know, it's very collaborative. And so look what you did. I love that.
Wow. This was a magical book for me, and one that I felt like any good book does, it made me feel closer to you for writing it. It made me trust you as an author, as a storyteller. It made me trust in you that Jackson and his family would be okay. It had a beautiful effect on me, and I know likewise on the readers that will be reading it, because my wife and my son heard it and had that same effect on them. And I know the online kidlit community, and we're already talking in such wonderful childlike ways about the wonder we're seeing in this book. So I can't say enough how thankful I am. Not only that I got to talk to you tonight, but also that Crenshaw exists and that it's there for our readers.
Oh, you're so kind. I gotta say, it's really gratifying to have people out there like you reading it and you know, taking it and making it your own. I think that's what we all do with books we love. You take a book to your heart, and even if you don't share it with anyone else, sometimes they just change you and you make that connection. So it's really gratifying and lovely to chat.
Love it. Well, let's take things from this beautiful sentiment to the music of the kickball field. Here we go. I'm assembling an all-star kidlit dream team kickball tournament. Hear the roar of the crowds, smell the Cracker Jack. That's what, yeah. I would go. That's where I would be taking it. I want to know, Catherine Applegate, what one person, alive or past, from the kidlit world you would want on your team, and why?
Oh, I hate questions like this. Even prepared for them, I mean. Because I'm so indecisive. Well, okay, first of all, I should say my husband, who is a kidlit writer, Michael Grant, but he writes for YA, and he writes darker, more serious stuff. So let's take him off the agenda. So he understands. I'm gonna go with Linda Urban. Do you know Linda Urban?
Can I just tell you how much I love Linda Urban? And just today, during piano lessons, I referenced A Crooked Kind of Perfect.
Oh, I love it. She is quite wonderful.
Is she?
And, oh, she's just, as a person, she's wonderful. I love the way she writes. She has this, I think what I so admire is that she's funny. And it is hard to be funny and profound at the same time, and to do it in a succinct way. And Linda Urban does that just magically. I can't recommend her books enough. She has a new, I just got it. I haven't even had a chance to read it yet. A new series out. I want to say Weekends with Max and His Dad. I'm going to garble the title, but it's just so charming. And I've already read like the first two pages and I'm in love. So, yes.
Yay, Linda Urban.
Now, I don't know, you know, really how she's going to be on the field. But, you know, we'll see what we can do with her.
Well, to bring back to your sentiment about Harvey, I always feel like if this question were turned on me, and it's been turned on me once or twice, I would want someone that I could just have a good time with. I could care less about the game if I could just be with my friends and have fun. So to hear you, how that sentiment makes me feel, just wonderful. Catherine, it has been an absolute pleasure to get to talk to you tonight about Crenshaw and just everything. Thank you for speaking music into this podcast, and just for the way that your story is working to all of us. Really, I really deeply appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute delight.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by Matthew Winner in his library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. Theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, there are a ton of great episodes of Let's Get Busy archived and waiting for you at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com. And if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on the blog or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.